Instead of putting a cracker under a politician, why not some TNT?
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is An Hour or Three with Dr. Robert Brennan, and my very special guest and the man of the hour is Dr. Andrew McIntyre. Dr. Andrew McIntyre is a gastroenterologist, and he's a part of a group of specialist doctors and GPs who are the first medical practitioners in Queensland to launch a legal challenge to the Chief Health Officer's COVID-19 vaccination mandate. The doctors will ask a judge to reverse the direction requiring them to be fully vaccinated regarding COVID-19 vaccinations, not the rest, to work in hospitals and other healthcare settings. Their Supreme Court judicial review application follows court challenges to vaccination mandates by police, nurses, ambulance officers, teachers, childcare centre workers and prison officers. Those cases still before the court. So good afternoon, Andrew.
Yeah, hi, Robert. How are you?
More importantly, how are you? Because you're going into a legal war zone. So tell us, what brought you on the journey from mild-mannered gastroenterologist to political dissident, one could say?
Well, I guess, you know, like most people, when this pandemic first appeared and we saw the pictures out of Italy and New York, it was alarming. And we're running an endoscopic day surgery facility, which would be very high risk. And Queensland Health were telling us that we might be called up to treat people, or the centre may be needed to treat people. So, you know, there's a fair bit of alarm. And as sort of director of the centre, really, I thought, well, I need to learn about this. So, you know, as a normal response, or the previous normal response, was to do the research. And so I've followed it very closely from the start, looking at, well, if we need to treat people, what do we need? We've upped our oxygen storage. We've done all sorts of stuff like that so that we were ready in case we were called on to treat people. But as time went on, and, you know, I guess when you do a lot of study, it doesn't take much to get back in the study habit where you do it every day. So I felt I was, you know, fairly up with things. But then the public health messaging started to diverge from what I really knew was the truth. And over time, that's just got worse and worse, to the point where, I mean, it's basically out and out lies sometimes, and particularly in the terms of early treatment. You know, I have been a user of ivermectin for 20 years, and to be honest, probably never researched it in the depth that I have now, but, you know, I started to see evidence of efficacy. I saw Tess Laurie's meta-analysis showing, you know, 60% reduction in mortality and the positive studies. Next, I see a question to the chief medical officer, the Australian one, saying, from the media, saying, what's your view of ivermectin? And he answers, there's been multiple clinical studies and not a single one shows any benefit. And I mean, I just about fell off my chair, because I mean, I knew that was false. You know, he could have said they were small, they were unreliable, we need a lot further studies, but he basically just said none of the studies show any benefit. So that was probably a defining moment for me, when I thought there's something very wrong here. I actually made an APRA complaint about him, saying he was purveyor of misinformation and it might discourage people from trying early treatment. They, of course, didn't do anything, but they didn't say that my point was wrong. And it's just, you know, got worse from there. So I guess gradually you realise that there's something not right. And, you know, when they introduced the mandates, it was, in my mind, not justifiable scientifically. And by that stage, the risks of the vaccine were quite clear. And, you know, over time, it's just got clearer and clearer that, A, it's not effective, and, B, that it's not safe, and that we should be using early treatment. And you know, I, like you, have probably been involved in writing letters to the TGA and health department, and there's just no response. It's, you know, they're completely ignoring some of the, not myself, but the people involved, and some of the most senior specialists in the country with incredible experience in, you know, respiratory immunology, who are trying to make the points and met with complete silence. They're not interested. So in the end, we're left with going to the Supreme Court to try and have a scientific argument, which is quite ridiculous, really. But that's where we're at, and it obviously comes at significant risk and expense. But what else do you do?
It does indeed, yes. And there's lots of issues there that you've raised that we can flesh out. But what has been the impact on your professional life thus far, apart from a disillusionment with the authority structures of the profession and the like? But what's been the impact on you as an individual practitioner?
Well, I really worked through all the lockdowns, and, you know, we continued to treat urgent patients and what have you. But from, I think, the 17th of December, because I wasn't vaccinated, I've been mandated out. So the private hospital, which I was just incredulous about, introduced their own mandate a few weeks before the state government introduced one. And that was without any consultation with visiting consultants. It was just imposed. So I resigned from there and used to do virtually all the ERCP at that hospital. So that service has disappeared and I can no longer do that. And then once the state government one came into place, I'm really not allowed to enter a day surgery that I'm own and am the director of. So, and I haven't worked since then. So I've got an interest in regenerative agriculture and have a couple of farms. So I've been quite busy, but I wasn't quite ready to retire at this point in time. Mm-hmm. So in some ways I've been enjoying myself, but under not the best of circumstances, you might say. Mm. Plus, it's quite disturbing what's going on. I mean, it is really quite disturbing to think that no scientific debate can be had. And I think any scientific debate would clearly show that what they've been doing virtually in every avenue has no scientific backup. And as time's gone on, there's really solid evidence that it's wrong, from lockdowns to masks and all those things. The evidence is now pretty clear that they're completely wrong. And, you know, we had a review of the pandemic plans apparently in 2019, and our 30-year pandemic plan was confirmed after examining all the evidence. But apparently at the direction of the WHO, we became China and did things that have never been done before. There's no evidence when they were instituted that they would work. And the only evidence since then is that they've actually done damage. And we have we have Sweden showing one of the lowest mortalities in Europe and they didn't do any of that stuff. So it's quite clear that I don't know why we did it, but it was definitely wrong. But there's no examination of outcomes that's gone on at all. So, and similarly with the vaccine, it's highly experimental treatment, but we rolled it out to everyone with very little follow-up. It should have been followed closely. And there's a lot of evidence there of really significant damage. And, you know, there's now the Denmark study showing no mortality benefit for the mRNA vaccines. Although interestingly, some mortality benefit for the adenovirus vaccines like AstraZeneca, which still carry risk, but they did that study did suggest that there was some overall benefit, but not for mRNA vaccines.
And no doubt, yes, and no doubt they'll, they being the, this diffuse enemy, let's call them they, them, there, they will go through the Danish study looking at all its methodological flaws and blow them up out of proportion, just like they did with the Danish mask study, that whilst it did have methodological flaws, it was the best they had. But it didn't bring the findings that they wanted. So it found against the effectiveness of masks, and now the Danes are doing it again. So yeah, the evidence is in, isn't it? But only to those who wish to see it, hear it. Yeah.
Well, that's, I think, part of the problem, and I've been racking my brains trying to figure out why the response of the medical profession has been, in my view, very poor. It appears to me that much of the profession just takes what's handed down on high without really any verification, and that I probably have a history of being involved in a lot of low-carb medicine for the last 5 years where, you know, quite by accident, I discovered that there was good evidence of, you know, massive therapeutic benefit from low-carb diets, and all the, you know, sites which you might go to, the textbooks, the medical summary sites really contain none of this evidence. And, you know, the dietitians' organizations were vehemently opposed. Gary Fetke, who you probably know in
Tasmania, he was one of my earlier interviews,
he was hauled up to APRA and cautioned for inappropriately reversing someone's diabetes, so which is sort of nonsensical. But this is a reflection of a bigger problem, I think, in the profession, where somehow we've been trained to follow orders, but very often those orders are highly conflicted.
Yeah,
and I think this is another example, a much more serious example, but, you know, I think an 800% increase in diabetes since 1960 is almost certainly related to dietary changes. And I think the whole low-fat, vegetable oil-based processed food diet is quite toxic. And really eating a high-fat, high animal fat diet is the healthiest thing people can do, as long as you keep the refined carbs low. But, and there's good evidence for it, but, you know, the common denominator is that some fairly large corporate entity is making trillions of dollars out of something. So that science is not allowed, it seems. So,
that's right, yes. Yeah, because his case is emblematic of the fact that that he was making enough of a footprint in the information landscape, say, that that the dietitians and their food pyramid and the cereal industry got wind of him, and they saw him as a threat, so they had to take him out. Because his vice, whilst it was in the best interest of the patient's health, it ran against the interests of those bigger power structures. And so, you know, he saw it coming, what's happened in our COVID era, as have you.
Yeah, no, and I've had experience with APRA myself. I was cautioned over, you know, a minor variation from an anesthetic protocol with, you know, fairly serious consequences if I hadn't have. And, you know, APRA took the view of you've deviated from the protocol, therefore you're guilty. And the guideline basically said, in emergent situations, some or all of these guidelines may need to be violated in the interests of the patient. But they were not interested in that. The medical defence are fairly hopeless at defending people against APRA. And not a single person, you know, this took 5 years to have it overturned, mind you. Not a single person spoke to me about the case in the whole 5 years. Mm. It was all handled with legal letters and what have you.
Mm.
Whereas I would have thought that, you know, in the past, someone would have rung up and said, well, why did you do that? I mean, there was no patient injury. Mm. It was actually patient benefit that was resulting from it. And there were no patient complaints. Mm. So, but not a single person rang me and said, oh, this is a little irregular. Why did you do that? And I could have explained it in 2 minutes probably, but I hate to think, well, I know I spent like $15,000 my own money on a non-medical defense lawyer, and we went to the ombudsman who had it reversed. But yes. I hate to think how much money was spent by medical defense and APRA
mm-hmm.
in really fighting what was nonsensical mm-hmm. with no patient injury, mm. Violating the sort of ridiculously anal interpretation of a guideline where there was actually scope to do more than enough scope to do what was done in an emergency situation.
Mm.
So I have that, and I was involved with Gary Fetke in the low carb movement, so I was well aware of what happened to him, and he had his caution reversed too, but probably took even longer than me. So
yes, but you practiced individualized medicine that's always given lip service, but when it goes up against the algorithmic process running, protocol running, sort of flowchart model of medicine, well, you're in trouble, which is just speaks to the culture of medicine that has become bureaucratic and roboticized and the like. And on that note, we're going to have a short ad break. This is TNT Radio.
Boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Nearly every day, we hear dire predictions about climate change from the media establishment, Hollywood, and politicians. They tell us that the world is coming to an end because normal human activity is raising the temperature to dangerous levels. To avoid a hellish apocalypse, they warn us we must immediately change our lifestyles and our very way of life. But are these sensational claims based on solid empirical science? Do the facts line up with the hype? Well, an increasing number of scientists are becoming skeptical. We covered what many of these scientists had to say in our first groundbreaking film, Climate Hustle. From overhyped claims about severe weather events, temperatures, rising sea levels, and even disappearing polar bears, Climate Hustle peeled back the hype and looked at the facts, facts that simply don't add up to any reason for alarm. So this begs the questions. Why would those claiming a global warming catastrophe spread a false narrative? What would motivate them? Why would they try to hustle you? Are they trying to control the climate or you? Well, those are the questions we're going to explore in this film. And the answers may shock you. Order your DVD, Blu-ray, or digital copy today of Climate Hustle 2.
To find out more, go to climatehustle2.com.
As an Olympic athlete, I prepare for everything. So when I became pregnant, I thought I was ready. But at 32 weeks, I was diagnosed with severe preeclampsia and had an emergency C-section. Looking back, had I known the warning signs, I would have talked to my doctor sooner. Too many women die of pregnancy-related complications, and most are preventable. If you or someone you know is pregnant or recently had a baby, learn the warning signs. It could help save her life. Hear her.
News more twisted than soap operas and with worse actors. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Robert Brennan and my very special guest, specialist physician, Dr. Andrew McIntyre. So just to drill down to the legal action that you're taking, let's talk about the vaccine and the vaccine mandate. So You're a health practitioner. You have your patient's best interests in mind. And they're telling you to get the vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine. And so the only way in which you being vaccinated would benefit the patient would be if you being vaccinated cuts your transmission risk. But tell us your assessment of that claim, or that which was the basis of the dogmatic assertion that you take it.
Yeah, well, there's probably a lot of points there. I mean, the first one is that asymptomatic transmission, if it happens at all, is incredibly rare. So, you know, if you don't go to work when you're sick, the chances of you giving a patient something are very low. Having said that, the medical tradition, certainly my whole working life, is you have to be nearly dead not to go to work. And people have always gone to work sick because there was no one to replace them. So there's an up and down side to not coming to work. But in terms of COVID, if you are asymptomatic, you're not going to transmit it. The second thing is that none of the trials were directed to transmission. There's no proof that it reduces transmission. And in fact, you know, the evidence over time is that it definitely does not reduce transmission. It does not actually reduce the risk of you getting COVID once you're a few months out from your initial vaccination. It increases your risk for the first few weeks after your first dose. And there's now clear evidence of negative efficacy. The Walgreens data in the US, which is similar to UK, Scotland and Israel, is that the lowest risk of getting COVID at the moment is the unvaccinated, and the highest risk is triple boosted after 5 months. So you have an increased risk of COVID if you've been vaccinated, and there's certainly absolutely no evidence of a reduced viral load if you're vaccinated. And there's, you know, some suggestion it might even be higher, and people may be more asymptomatic, which means, you know, that there is a possibility, I'm not claiming it, but there's a possibility that having medical staff vaccinated would increase the risk to patients. And there's absolutely zero evidence that it would reduce the risk. So it's illogical. I'd have to say I've never advised a patient to have the vaccine. That's not my primary role as a specialist, but you know, there's a few of my patients who are young and fit who I have said, look, I don't think it's worth the risk in your case. And I certainly have the view that with the evidence we have now, there's virtually no age group where you can say there's a clear risk reduction by being vaccinated. So that's where we stand at the moment. And in many cases, I think the vaccination risks, even with our current data, are possibly higher than the COVID risks. We have no long-term follow-up, so we really don't know what's going to happen with them in the long run. I mean, they're completely novel technology, and there's evidence of people, you know, producing spike protein out to 15 months or 6 months, I can't remember. Certainly, it persists in people's circulation for quite a while after the vaccine. There is some evidence of integration into DNA, which raises the possibility that, you know, they'll never stop producing it. And it's certainly a pathogenic protein with increased risks of blood clotting.
Yes. In your patient's best interests, there's no utility.
Yep.
There's putative harm to yourself, but Dr. McIntyre, we're so dearly concerned about your health and your well-being. We're worried that if you don't get vaccinated, you will get ill from COVID. You might die from COVID. This will save your life. And we've even got to deprive you of employment to save your life, to force you into having it. So what's your take on that?
Well, I think that's very much a personal decision, isn't it? And, you know, if people want to be vaccinated, They should be informed, but it's very much a personal choice. And, you know, as part of my initial study before the vaccines, I, you know, read about the possibility of ADE from these things that would never produced a successful coronavirus vaccine in any animal species, and that it often took 12 months for the ADE to show up, and a lot of the animals would die. And with SARS-CoV-1, after 7 years, they gave up because all the animal models showed no benefit. So my attitude was reduce your risks of COVID, as in vitamin D, and having a couple of farms, I'm sure my vitamin D is through the roof. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think processed food with low vitamin D intake is a risk factor, you know, so making yourself healthy with normal vitamin D levels makes your risk of dying of COVID incredibly low. I mean, you can't change your age, but the vaccine is an unknown risk. And some of those risks probably, you know, go out for several years. And I think we're seeing some of this now. It's too early to be sure, but there's certainly studies showing that vaccinated people who get COVID don't seem to develop nucleocapsid antibodies, certainly like 20% do versus 95% of unvaccinated. And there's a fair bit of data around that people are being reinfected. Well, they're claiming, you know, another attack of COVID. And according to the theory of original antigenic sin, your immune response to a virus really reflects your initial response. And if you're only producing antibodies to spike protein when you meet the virus, that's all you do the second time. So the nucleocapsid part of the virus is much more stable. So having antibodies to that makes it more likely that you'll handle future variants. Now, all of this is speculative. And my understanding of it all was speculative at the start. But, you know, from my knowledge, my experience, I was not happy with the theoretical safety of it from the start. And it's, you know, it's my right to say thanks, but no thanks. I'll work on all the other factors that reduce your risk, but I'm not comfortable with this one. And that's basic human right. Mm-hmm. So I guess people shut up to some extent because, you know, I thought the whole vaccine rollout was reckless. But you think, oh, it'll probably be all right, but Jesus, they're taking a risk. Mm-hmm. You know, and as time goes on, it has been reckless, and there's lots of concerning signs that the gamble has not paid off in any way, shape, and form. So, you know, what is the saying? Where there's risk, there must be choice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not going to take something from it that intellectually I'm doubtful about because of some possible benefit. That's just the way I am. So, yes.
And that where there's risk, there must be choice. That's one of the rally cries that we make on the weekend. And we're both going to be speaking at the rally in Brisbane.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah. So
it's another thing that we never thought we'd be doing in 2019, because, of course, it was upwards of late 2019 when there were, and you alluded to this, there were existing pandemic plans across the globe, and they just threw them out the window in early 2020. Everything became a bit about the development of the vaccine that you're going to have, whether you like it or not, whether it works or not. Yeah.
Well, that's the concern with this WHO treaty seems likely to be signed, is that Australia will be under the direct direction of the WHO, who seem to favour tyrannical procedures. Mm-hmm. I would have thought that there should be a referendum before we adopt that, but it seems like the politicians are just letting it through. So I think people, it's got to the point where people do need to stand up. Mm. I mean, the powers that be are not interested in scientific debate. That's clear. We've tried that. They don't listen.
Mm-hmm.
They extract revenge on anyone who attempts to debate the issue. So I think the people have to take things into their own hands and actually say no.
Mm. Indeed, yes. And, our prime ministers and presidents are just middle management nowadays. And what's happened to you in terms of not being able to be currently employed is shared with many of our friends, many of whom we know and who are represented in this action. So before, in the third part, we talk about the action itself, let's talk about the Queensland chief health officers, past and present, throughout the pandemic. What's your assessment on them? For example, we've moved from one who was in Jeanette Young, who was a career bureaucrat who is on record of saying that she knows nothing about infectious diseases, to the current chief health officer, where his speciality is infectious diseases. So I would have expected a more learned, a more nuanced approach to the problem, and yet his initial few comments before I shut off was just, this is just utterances of another bureaucrat. He'll make a good future governor one day, maybe. So, so what's your take?
Well, I don't really know him personally, and I can't say I've extensively researched him, but his public statements and some statements I've seen from an affidavit where for the mandate, where he basically says it will reduce infection and therefore transmission are completely not backed by the science. So I'm sure there's an awful lot of politics at that level.
Mm-hmm.
So there was another person who was going to take the role who resigned before he took it up. So maybe he got a look at what it was expected of him and decided it wasn't for him. Mm-hmm. So I have no personal knowledge of the man. I mean, saying that the anti-vaxxers are getting too much oxygen is quite insulting, really. I mean, certainly not been an anti-vaxxer. This is therapy. I mean, it certainly failed as a vaccine. It doesn't give you sterilizing immunity. That's quite clear. You know, the last claim is that it reduces severity, but we need to wait, because if the ADE is real and there's some indication that it is, it could actually increase mortality over a long period. And that, you know, the boosters were introduced with absolutely zero evidence for efficacy. And I wonder if they were rushed in because they were starting to see evidence for ADE. So they figured, let's boost them and get past this. I don't know, but to boost people without any evidence of efficacy, and certainly, you know, undeniable evidence of potential harm, is it's again reckless. It's you know, giving people another dose of an experimental medicine in the hope that it'll work, when there's evidence that it does harm. So it is quite reckless, and I certainly just cannot believe that it's being done around the world. And there have been multiple countries, you know, 6 months ahead of us, where the evidence for that was particularly clear. Like in Israel, it's quite clear that boosters have been a failure.
Mm.
So why are we pushing them here? It completely escapes me. So, and the lack of objection by a lot of the medical profession completely escapes me. But I think we've sort of, there's possibly a generation of doctors who've been trained to follow guidelines and be obedient, and feel like they're not qualified to read evidence and come up with their own treatment plan. That's Partially my concern. I have experienced some of that with low carb. You know, a GP who insists the patient goes on a statin because of her LDL, and I ring her up and say, well, you know, her triglycerides are nothing and her HDL's good and the ratio's excellent. I've done her LDL subfractions and she's low risk and she's got a coronary artery calcium score of zero, which means she has no benefit of statins for 10 years, you know, there's no 10-year benefit. So I don't think she needs it and I don't think we need to worry about a lipid profile. And she says, my calculator says she needs to be on one. Mm-hmm. And until my calculator includes the CAC, she's going on a statin. I'm going, I'll send you the article. Mm. It's clear, but it is, you know, and part of it is, you know, practice incentive payments and things that you need to have a certain percentage of your patients on a statin or whatever. So, you know, slowly by slowly, they're turning the medical profession into rule followers, which, you know, superficially might be good, but when something is wrong, it enshrines it really often for decades before it's corrected. So, and I mean, the editors of the New England Journal and BMJ have both said 50% of what you read is garbage. It's wrong. So,
and the irony is that you don't really know what 50% it is until you wait around a few years. And on that note, we're just going to go to a quick ad break. This is TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
Most Republicans and Democrats are divided on many issues, but the vast majority support Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky administration and vehemently oppose Russia's military intervention in Ukraine. Not to be alarmist, but it is possible that the November midterm elections may not occur if the Biden administration continues to provoke Russia towards world war. President Biden boasted in a recent speech that the United States has sent more than $3 billion in security assistance to Ukraine to frustrate President Putin's alleged desire to dominate the nation. This includes a commitment of more than 5,500 Javelin missiles. The United States has invaded and bombed more nations than any other and has no moral high ground against Russia's defensive military action in Ukraine. US politicians supporting the supply of weapons to attack Russia risk much more than a cancelled midterm election. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Using meth taught me everything about freedom, only not like you think. It taught me how easy it is to lose your freedom. If you think meth is taking control of you, ask for help. You have the power to be truly free. I know. I'm Jan, and I'm free from meth.
If you or someone you know is struggling with meth, call 1-800-662-HELP for 24-hour free and confidential treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/meth.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative, this is Viewpoint.
Working group meetings for the WHO pandemic treaty have been taking place behind closed doors. On the 18th of February 2022, the Working Group on Strengthening WHO Preparedness and Response, WGPR, to Health Emergencies, held its seventh meeting. Recommendations were issued including surveillance systems that would link into each country's national health system, the implementation of universal digital vaccination certificates, and guidelines on how each member country would be paying fees to the World Health Organization, in addition to the annual membership fees each member country is already paying. It proposed that states' parties should ensure adequate and sustained financing at the national and subnational levels and provide adequate and sustained financing to the WHO Secretariat for its work on preventing, detecting, and responding to disease outbreaks. An international pandemic financing faculty is recommended to raise additional reliable financing for pandemic preparedness and for rapid global finance surge for response in the event of a pandemic. The facility should have the capacity to mobilize long-term 10 to 15-year contributions of approximately $5 to $10 billion per annum to finance ongoing preparedness functions. It will have the ability to disperse up to $50 to $100 billion at short notice by front-loading future commitments in the event of a pandemic declaration.
If you want the jibby jab, all right, enough. Then you've come to the wrong station. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Robert Brennan with specialist physician, gastroenterologist, Dr. Andrew McIntyre, who's the spokesperson for a group of doctors who are taking on this anti-scientific, anti-ethical vaccine mandate here in Queensland. So tell us about, Andrew, the legal action itself, and also are you needing to raise funds? Is there some website that people can access?
You know, we certainly will need to raise funds. Many of us have been looking for an avenue, and we've found, you know, a legal person who was definitely on our side, which is an important thing in the situation. So we've really all put money in to get it to where it is at this point in time. But to engage expert witnesses, court appearance fees and what have you, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, and I guess if we lost, which I personally think's impossible if we get a fair hearing, then we could get costs awarded against us. So we're in the process of setting up a Give, Send, Go donation site to try and elicit some help. And I already had a call from a A&E consultant in Victoria today offering to help get some donations because they're well and truly fed up with what they're seeing. So, and while it's only Queensland, once you can get a decision, it does set a lot of precedents for other places. The real question is, will they find a way to not have the scientific argument? Because nobody wants to have the scientific argument, it would appear at this stage. So the strategy is to block having the discussion. We'll see what's thrown at us on that front. So, but it, in the end, we've come to the conclusion that someone needs to try. We didn't really want it to be us, but in the absence of anyone else putting their hand up, I guess it's us. So, we're hoping that our stand will encourage other people to maybe speak out a little bit more, the medical profession to perhaps give us some financial support to try and have these mandates ended, because I'm sure there's lots of vaccinated people who are not at all keen on having ongoing boosters, having witnessed, really, it's pretty close to carnage. I mean, when the health minister says there's a 30% increase in ambulance calls for chest pain and shortness of breath, it's happening all around the state.
Oh, well, now you're a coincidence theorist, not a conspiracy theorist.
That's
right. And yes, if not you, then who? If not now, then when? And you're out there doing it. And so the thrust of your case, I mean, we've spoken about the theme, but is there anything more about the mechanics of it, the legal strategy that you're employing, or is it just merits-based, science-based? You're going to try and have that conversation finally where the chief health officer will be forced to say, give his reasons for upholding.
Well, that's what we're after. We're after a debate on the reasons to continue the mandate. We had to put the case in a hurry because you only have 28 days to challenge a decision. So we were right on the edge of that. And interestingly, the Human Rights Commission has intervened in, you know, there's quite a few similar cases by other people, basically saying that it does violate Queensland's human rights legislation, which is what we've thought for a long time. I'm not sure why they've remained quiet until now. I mean, the concern is that that's a stimulus to change them to make it legal. Still, that is an aspect of our case. I mean, there is a way they can dodge it by, I think, saying it's a legislative, not administrative decision, which means it you're not entitled to challenge it. But that is going to be one of the questions of law that needs to be heard. So, you know, in all these things, there is not a clear path to have that scientific debate. But one way or another, we're, you know, the public deserve to hear a scientific debate. And it's our view that the case is extremely strong. I can't really find any evidence to justify the decisions. So, but that basically means they're going to fight hard to avoid having the scientific argument. So in the end, the public might need to demand change if they basically refuse to have the argument. But I guess the case throws a highlight on the situation. It generates talk. It generates publicity. From my perspective, it lets the public know that not all the medical profession are on board, which, I mean, there's been a shocking loss of trust in the medical profession. So I've certainly had, you know, friends of other people contact me because they're too scared to go to hospital. And do I know anyone that isn't, you know, deep in the narrative that they can go and see? I mean, that's happened so many times that they want to see someone, ideally who's unvaccinated, because they're too scared to go to the doctor, you know, that they may be unvaccinated and they've been treated really incredibly poorly. When the, you know, they're perfectly well, the medical profession should understand that a well person does not present them with any risk, but, you know, they're seen in the car park or only on Zoom. So it's you know, I'm really quite upset about what's happened to medical care as a result of this. I mean, I've seen a few patients on Zoom, but I don't find it particularly satisfying. You need to be able to read a patient, I think, and talk to them. And Zoom is not that. And I guess a lot of my work is procedural. I mean,
you can't palpate a liver or do a colonoscopy via Zoom.
No, exactly. And just even the human interaction to get a feel for someone, it's not the same on Zoom, I don't think. So I don't find it like an adequate replacement. You know, I've treated COVID and all sorts of things remotely, but I'm not really trying to practice on Zoom because I don't find it adequate in reality for decent medical care. But, you know, I've also found that people who are unvaccinated can be treated atrociously by some of the profession who are like inappropriately concerned about this patient. It's like, I mean, Omicron is everywhere. There's no evidence that anyone's vaccination status makes any difference to them getting it or transmitting it. So we just need to accept there's a virus going around and just act like we normally act, and life could go back to normal in reality. So, and there's far more damage done by, you know, all of this garbage than the disease itself. So, so it's I struggle to work out why it's happened. But I think the mass formation theory is very true. People become very deep. And even the doctors who are like that, they don't want a scientific discussion either. It's they just want to accept the narrative and not be challenged rather than debate it, you know. So,
which is at the heart of science. It isn't what you do in a laboratory, but it's the open inquiry and the placing one's hypothesis to the test, which is something which the likes of the chief health officer would rather we not do. You know, you were saying about how there's some support from, as one example, by an A&E consultant from an accident and emergency consultant from Victoria. But we also have, in the broad church of those critical of the government's response, we have luminaries like Professor Thomas Brodie, Professor Tom Clancy, you know, gastroenterologists and immunologists respectively. You've also had some support from Professor Russell Strong, who's a surgical rock star here in Queensland. He was the first to do a live donor liver transplant and saved dozens of kids' lives with liver transplants.
Yeah, no, I worked with him at PA when I was a registrar, and I did a lot of the RCP as a registrar. So, you know, I interacted with him quite a lot, being, you know, the liver transplant unit. Mm-hmm. But I haven't spoken to him for 25 years probably. But I had a phone call from him the Monday after the article was published saying that he fully supports the action, that he doesn't believe in the mandates, and that I can use his name, mm-hmm. you know, in the context of our case, saying he supports it. So for many surgeons in Queensland, you know, that's incredibly powerful. If you, you know, he is a very well-respected figure in Queensland. And I think his attitude's changed over time, and you know, people's attitude does need to change with the data. But I'm talking to him, he's very up with the current data on this. He's very knowledgeable about all the figures from all over the world, and
history is repeating, because it was our own august Medical Journal of Australia who chastised him for his early work in liver surgery, even though he had the last laugh. He saved those lives. And so, you know, he's gone up against the system before, as he and you are doing now. And yeah, there's a lesson in that, isn't there?
Yeah, I think, you know, open... I think it's Gary Fettke's quote. Again, it's like science thrives by being challenged, not by being followed. Mm-hmm. You should continue to try and disprove your hypothesis, because you can never be sure whether something's true. You can really only be sure that it's not true. Hypothesis has to withstand challenge, and over time it becomes accepted if the challenges fail. I mean, if you're resisting challenge, it suggests that you don't have confidence in your hypothesis. And, you know, the public health entities in Australia clearly don't have confidence in their hypothesis, because they are, you know, deregistering people who challenge their hypothesis with sound science. But the truth always comes out in the end. And
you and your fellow doctors who are on part of the crew are fighting to have that truth heard. So, doctors, you're listening out there, time to take a side. Now is the hour of decision. And my special guest has been Dr. Andrew McIntyre, whose group of doctors are taking on the Queensland Chief Health Officer re-the-vaccine mandates. This is TNT Radio. Thank you.